What makes a home? Is it the place you're born? Is it a childhood bedroom with well-worn curtains? Is it a loved one's embrace? Is it your first apartment out on your own, or a city you've dreamt of moving to your whole life? Or maybe the questions are a little bit more complicated. Do you get to choose where you make home? Or is making home a process that happens to us, even at times, unexpectedly? As a kid, I found myself in an urban preschool in Cleveland Heights. We had just moved out of a basement apartment into our first real house. Even though it was a unit in a duplex with broken screens and dusty carpets, you would have seen me running through the living room exclaiming, "It is so big!" At that time, in Mandarin, my first language. We had an old fireplace that probably sat there unused for decades. I remember my dad sweeping up the ashes, bringing in some collected wood scraps from the yard, and lighting the first flame. Our family together huddled close to the fire, our eyes intently gazing at our newfound home. My dad then raced to the kitchen to grab the sweet potatoes, which he wrapped in aluminum foil and nestled neatly among the hot coals. The smell was distinct, an earthy, nutty aroma of caramelized sugar. Those days still remain vividly with me after all these years. Memories of survival, of simplicity, of love, of home. Within a short year, my family left Cleveland for Toledo. But we'll get to that chapter of the story next week. I've been back in Toledo for 8 years now, after a few stints on the East Coast. And these years have brought new meaning to my sense of home. It's no longer just a place I'm born in, or even brought to, but an act of choice and commitment. And maybe, if you're like me, you'll make a similar kind of commitment to your home. Part of my story, and the mid-story, is that we remind those of you listening, wherever you are, that home is indeed what you make it. And that also means that we're responsible for making it what we hope it can be. Are there perhaps lessons that we can learn, new things to discover in the process of making this home? And how does one make somewhere else, a place that just might be unfamiliar, home? Welcome to the Midstory Hour, a show produced by Midstory in collaboration with WGTE. I'm your host, Samuel Chang. This week, we're featuring stories about making home in unexpected places. Here at Midstory, we believe in the power of storytelling, especially about the places we call home. We've covered thousands of stories from across all 12 Midwest states, and each week on the Midstory Hour, we will share a few with you. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to learn something new about the place you call home. And likewise, learn something new about places you've never been. This week, listen to the second episode of Midstory's brand new podcast, Brain Drain, to take a deep dive into the difficult and complex decision to leave home, or likewise, to stay. Next, we're bringing to you a fascinating story of adaptive reuse, how what was once an automobile finishing plant is now home to the Toledo School for the Arts. Then, hear about how the nation's most prestigious coin collection will trade the bustle of New York for the promise of Toledo, and what that could mean for the Glass City. If you enjoy this program, be sure to listen to other episodes and check us out at midstory.org or on our socials. It's no secret that post-industrial cities like Toledo are struggling with depopulation? What are the reasons people leave? And what would convince them to stay? To answer these questions, we interviewed dozens of Toledoans, people who've left, people who've stayed, and everyone in between. Today, we're bringing you the next episode of Brain Drain, a new series from the team at Midstory. It's a podcast 7 years in the making, and at the core of why we came home. Episode 2 takes a look at Toledo's downtown social life, and how despite various heroic efforts, the city's still figuring out how to attract young people to its urban core. Learn more about this podcast, explore data visuals, and tune in to future episodes at midstory.org/braindrain.
As we travel across this great Salem commercial known as the Midwest.
In 1973, John Denver sang a song about Toledo to an estimated 30 million viewers of the Johnny Carson Show.
I would like to dedicate this next song to those of you who are not from the city of which I sing.
It was not flattering.
Saturday night in Toledo, Ohio is like being nowhere at all.
What follows describes a place where there is nothing to do except sit in the park and watch the grass die, where the sidewalks are rolled in by 10 p.m., and where great entertainment is watching the buns rise in the bakery. At the time, John Denver's song Rocky Mountain High occupied the number 3 spot on the pop charts.
Colorado, Rocky Mountain High.
News of his bruising new ballad made its way to Northwest Ohio, where some Toledoans were offended. Toledo's mayor told the press that the song was offensive as hell. Blade reporter Tony Gearhart called Denver a no-account slanderer and a furrow-browed, demon-eyed, nothing-is-sacred pop singer. But for other Toledoans, the song struck a chord. Several letters to the editor published in The Blade said the song wasn't a dastardly lie like Gearhart described it.
Let's face it, Toledo is not the excitement capital of the country.
Life in Toledo is a drag. If it's not going to see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, there's nothing to do at my age except listen to the bees buzz by.
Denver said he'd never heard from anyone who was offended by the song. Former Toledoans have come up to me after the show and laughed about it, and they all say it's true, he said. At the time, several recessions, urban renewal projects, and a mass exodus to the suburbs had left Toledo's once bustling center desolate and lacking the restaurants and entertainment venues that once gave it life. A lot has changed since those times. In 2017, ProMedica, a major healthcare conglomerate, moved their headquarters downtown. A 5-year development plan and a series of public-private partnerships spurred a major renovation of the riverfront, with parks, apartments, restaurants, and retail flocking to the banks of the Maumee.
Hold on, I don't want you guys to think that we've got everything against Toledo.
But still, the legacy of Saturday night in Toledo, Ohio lives on. Toledo is still not known for being an excitement capital of the nation, or even of Ohio. Despite all the changes, many are still frustrated that downtown Toledo isn't what it could be. For many, it's a reason they want to pull up their stakes and head elsewhere. Welcome to Brain Drain, a brand new mid-story production that presents an average American city through the eyes of the people who've left it behind. I'm Yannick Schaller. Episode 2, Like Being Nowhere at All. In our first episode, we spent a lot of time talking about Toledo's past. But for the rest of the series, we're going to be focusing on the city's present and future. And Toledo's future, just like every other city's, lies in the hands of the next generation of thinkers, dreamers, and doers. The same young people that Toledo has had such a hard time holding onto over the last few decades.
Hi, I'm Yasu.
Young people like Yasu.
I go to Oberlin College, though I'm originally from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Yasu was part of MidStory's annual summer internship program and spent over 2 months, or about 9 Saturday nights, in Toledo. Given that bright young people like Yasu are exactly the demographic we're talking about, my co-host Daya and I thought that our interns would make for some pretty compelling reporters. We sent them out into the city, and for the rest of the season, we'll be sharing the mic with them. I'd like to hear from you about what your first impression was when you arrived here in Toledo this summer. What did you make of it?
I remember the first time that on the first week we were here when we went downtown for the first time. The downtown area, it's almost eerie how quiet it is, which is, I think, a little surprising for a city so large.
But you also spoke to a lot of other people in your work for the podcast. What did they have to say when you asked them about what their understanding of what downtown was like?
There were mixed impressions. A lot of the older people I talked to, they seemed very, very proud of Toledo in all ways and very willing to defend the fact that there was a lot to do. A lot of younger people I talked to seemed to have a much more mixed at best impression that there was maybe not terribly much to do, maybe that other places they had been more exciting and more engaging.
Who's an example of that younger sort of demographic?
Mel Monaghan.
Mel Monaghan has lived in Northwest Ohio for pretty much her whole life. She left to attend college at The Ohio State University and then moved back to Toledo and started working downtown.
It's kind of like a battle. Like, I see stuff coming. I see the good plans, and it's hard to articulate, but I also am down here all day and there's not a lot of people down here, and I'll go to lunch and there's no one really there.
Mel's 25. In the time since we spoke to her, she's moved to Chicago. Much of Mel's family is still in Toledo, so it made sense when she described the city as very family-oriented. That's something that a lot of Toledoans we talked to said, including those who had left, those who stayed around, and those who came back. Its suburban character and safe, extensive parks make it a great place to raise children. For many families, that's a draw, but Mel said for young people seeking to mingle with their peers, Toledo has some work to do.
Toledo is a wonderful place to have a family, to be with your family. I'm still enjoying that, but I'm not sure if that's my path for the future, to have my own family anytime soon. There's not a sense of community that I can find for people my age that's large and where they're also living and hanging out. I feel like it's kind of spread out with the suburbs, so maybe people would just want that big city feeling.
Mel hopes to find this big city feeling in Chicago. She said that for her to stay, Toledo would need a better community and more spaces for young people to meet and socialize. But some people have found spaces in the city that do hit that mark. Take Jalen Toll, for example.
I live downtown, so I really do live for the downtown entertainment.
Jalen lives in a loft with a view of the art museum. He's a DJ and loves going to rooftop bars, of which there are few in Toledo. He's excited about staking his claim in what he sees as a developing area. Still, he has to admit that Toledo can be very average all the time, even compared to other places he's lived in Ohio.
You go downtown Columbus, go down the main drag downtown, you're really looking at least 500 to 1,000 people pretty much every time you step foot down there. I was downtown Toledo last night on a Thursday night, which in most big cities is the start of the weekend. I saw maybe 100 people downtown, and I was out from like 3 p.m. to like 2 a.m. I spent a good 10 hours downtown, and there was not a lot of people.
Jalen's Thursday was underwhelming, but on a Friday night, it's a whole different story. Yasu met Jalen at Party in the Park. It's one of the things to do on a weekend night in Toledo, and it's part of an attempt by politicians, business people, and civic organizations to transform the city's downtown. Like most things in Toledo, the city's social life was most vibrant in the early 20th century. Since then, the city's development has been characterized by stops and starts, by big plans and setbacks, by promises and disappointments. In the early and mid-20th century, Toledo had a strong live music scene. In the 1920s, Toledo was a national destination in the jazz world, where renowned artists like Art Tatum and John Hendricks got their start.
But here he is, jumping and jolting, Jerry Lee Lewis!
During the rock and roll era, the city was a pit stop for greats, including Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry, and Frankie Valli, all of whom graced the stage at the Peppermint Club on Jefferson Avenue. However, after World War II, the city's entertainment district suffered as the city's economy took a dive. White flight and new highways took people and money out of urban centers across the country. As downtown businesses fell into disrepair, municipal leaders began to see the city's center as blighted and bad for its public image. In the 1960s, the city undertook several massive urban renewal projects around downtown. Over the course of the decade, 88 acres along the city's riverfront were razed, and a total of 200 commercial buildings were demolished from the downtown area. Toledo's downtown was eventually rebuilt with office buildings and other structures, but the area remained a hollowed-out version of what it was before. Looking at maps of downtown today and in 1950, the difference is immediately recognizable. In the mid-1900s, Toledo's core was a grid of tightly packed buildings. Today, the landscape includes far fewer structures, separated by wide parking lots and empty space. However, in the mid-80s, something happened that Toledoans would talk about for a long time. The original party in the park arrived on the Maumee River. Toledoans over 50 remember white-collar and blue-collar workers alike gathering to socialize and dance the night away. Crowds were packed so tightly that it was impossible to walk through them. Party in the Park was organized by the JCs, or the Junior Chamber of Commerce, an organization of young professionals dedicated to improving the city. Concerts drew 2,000 people some weeks and brought in national hitmakers like Jefferson Starship and the B-52s, as well as popular local bands. After 1987, it was rebranded as Rally by the River, but summertime concerts continued without much change for a couple of decades. Then, in 2008, the global economy crashed. The city of Toledo no longer had money in the budget to spare for live music. Without their support, CityFest, the nonprofit that organized the concerts, dissolved. Summer evenings in downtown Toledo were quiet once again. But not for long. In 2017, the nonprofit healthcare conglomerate ProMedica moved its headquarters to downtown Toledo. The company invested $60 million downtown, which funded the renovation of several historic buildings and Promenade Park. Jalen said these changes did a lot to give Toledo the feeling of a world-class city.
I used to come down to the Promenade Park area and run and work out. There was a chain, pretty much gate or railing, keeping you from falling in the river. Since then, they've removed that. Now they have fences down here. They have a whole pier, they have a walkway, they have a park with new sculptures and lighting and high-tech video boards with the time and the temperature and ads running all day.
The renovated Promenade Park reopened in 2017. That summer, ProMedica started a concert series to go with it.
Do you want the funk? The whole funk? And nothing but the funk.
The superheroes of disco.
It's a 90s house party.
Friday, July 8th at Promenade Park.
Promenade Park.
Promenade Park in downtown Toledo. Tickets on sale now at ProMedicaLive.com.
This moment for Toledo was powerful, but it was also short-lived. It's probably unfair to expect a single corporation to sustain Toledo's downtown forever. In 2023, financial woes led ProMedica to majorly reduce its philanthropy. The downtown concert series was affected, too.
ProMedica's reported financial struggles have caused them to cut down their summer concert lineup this year. On the other hand, they are asking the city and county for more money than ever before.
The city and county agreed. Promenade Park hosted 4 concerts that summer, half as many as the year before. In the fall, ProMedica pulled the plug. The city then hired a concert promoter from Michigan to run the 2024 concert season. Following the season, he asked the city to take on more risk associated with the venture. Then he abruptly quit. In 2025, Toledo tried something new. The concerts would all feature local artists. They would also all be free.
Yasu, you actually attended one of these concerts. They happen weekly over the summer in Toledo now. Can you talk me through what your first impression of Partying the Park was? You walked in, what did you see?
It was a beautiful evening in July. We drove downtown, and that was actually probably the moment where it was probably most interesting to me, in that the streets were empty all around the downtown area. We found parking pretty easily, which I think was in some ways kind of surprising. But anyway, it seemed like there was pretty much no one around. But then as we walked closer to the waterfront, there was clearly a gathering of people where live music was playing and people were out on boats down by the river, and it was actually quite nice.
We are going through a renaissance, and it's really cool to be a part of something like that.
Ash Lehman played a big part in making the 2025 concert series a reality.
I'm the director of marketing and events at Connect Toledo, Downtown Toledo Improvement District.
Along with promoting events in Downtown Toledo, a big part of Ash's job is coordinating with local businesses to get financial backing for Connect Toledo's programming. In the last few years, her focus has been on bringing activity back to the city's newly developed waterfront. After the ProMedica series fizzled out, she wondered whether it might be time to bring back its predecessor.
Working in Toledo for, the last 10 years, it would come up all the time where, some of my mentors would talk about Party in the Park and Rally by the River and how wonderful it was. And it was free. And it brought so many people down here to just have fun. And we played around with that idea. And how can we make that viable now?
Connect Toledo contributed most of the funding for the new Party in the Park, $200,000 in total, while the city gave $60,000, another nonprofit, Destination Toledo, put in $50,000.
The woman that works with everybody to pull it all together, Cheryl Hardy!
Cheryl Hardy Dillon, a consultant hired to organize the event, explained that every dollar invested in the project had the potential to put more than double that into the downtown economy.
Our goals were that we wanted to get 2,000 people per week downtown to spend $35 a person. So you can do the math, and it's, $1 million or so back into the economy. We have to be able to drive people here, and charging people to get down here isn't a way to drive people down here.
Hey, since this is free, that means you've got money in your wallets and purses. You can help support an acoustic...
So on a Friday night in July, we're in Promenade Park, and Cheryl's bet seems to be paying off. A few hundred people are seated along the grassy slope, leading down to a stage where a local gospel group called Nikki D and the Sisters of Thunder are belting out R&B songs. Arctic Clam will be on later. Down by the river, pedestrians stroll along the walkway. Others hang out on boats, sitting in the harbor. The people we talk to really appreciate how downtown Toledo has improved.
It's just amazing how much has come up in the city. I don't feel like you could have done this 10 years ago, where you wouldn't have felt like there was anything going on downtown.
It's gotten better. I can tell you, when we were kids, used to come down here, your guys' age, it was completely different animal down here than what it is now.
I'll tell you, the place is looking great now with all the paintings going on. You can find anything in Toledo you want. You got music, you got your clubs, just come down here and see people and hang out. It's a good time. Everybody, just have a good time and everybody get along.
The crowd is mostly older. There are some families, a handful of young people.
Do you guys like this music? I mean, my guess is you and your friends aren't planning to come down here on the weekend, and that's okay. I mean, you're not our target market, so that is okay. But what is our target market? Because guess what? This park is not activated on Saturdays.
But Cheryl does think that beyond Partying the Park, Toledo needs to develop programming that is targeted towards a younger demographic.
I think it's really important that we do some things to keep young people, and I think that is a really difficult thing for someone like me to touch, because I'm not young anymore. Well, I might have that great organizational skill set that allows us to bring a bunch of people together, but we really do need some young people to step up into leadership positions and make some things happen that are interesting for young people, because that's how we keep our youth here and that's how we keep our talent here.
Many of the young people we talk to agree that downtown Toledo does not seem to fit their interests yet.
I feel like Toledo is incredibly average all the time. I feel like comparatively, Toledo's a lot smaller and rural and poorer than a lot of people understand. And I don't mean that they're dumb, just if you're not exposed to more money and more energy and more people, you don't know what you don't know. I'm an artist and a DJ myself, so I definitely feel like this is something I would love to do myself. I'd love to go perform in front of this, and I think it would be a good time. So I definitely can't say I don't believe in it being fun, but I feel like sometimes, not to speak down on any of the artists, I just don't know if it's what everyone wants to hear.
What do you think people want to hear?
I mean, Drake's the most selling artist in the world. So I mean, people want to hear me singing rap. I think people want to hear, they want to hear exciting local things. I'm not saying these people are boring or lame, but like I said, Drake's the most selling artist in the world. I mean, those numbers show what the people want.
Drake, of course, will not be headlining at Party in the Park anytime soon. This isn't New York or LA. We've heard this line from a lot of people who are trying to shift the narrative about Toledo. The small city on the Maumee will never be like those metropolises, and that's okay. But what can it be instead? For Ash Lehman, developing downtown is key to challenging this perception. While much of the programming Connect Toledo does is focused on bringing in families from the suburbs, there is a growing community of people who have moved downtown seeking the energy of a city.
Like, you know, we did the research and found out that, you know, most of the people that live downtown, they're either right out of college that are coming down here. They get a job at OI or something like that, right? And or it's empty nesters. So two totally different groups, but I think we have enough to offer for both of those demographics. So, you know, we've really been trying to focus on creating events and community engagement opportunities for the folks that live downtown so that they feel more engaged in the city and they eventually feel as passionately as I do. Oh, I don't know if anyone would be as passionate as I am about it.
Ash lives in the Old West End, a historic neighborhood of Victorian homes just off of downtown. She's 39, single, with two dogs. Jalen Toll's loft is nearby. In other sections of Toledo, single artists or professionals like Ash or Jalen might seem out of place, but in the Old West End and other areas around downtown, they are the norm.
I've noticed a lot of people that live down here, like, mostly have dogs or cats. they don't really have children, and if they do, they're not living in the home.
Many of Ash's neighbors are what she calls boomerangs, people who left Toledo and then came back. Ash is one of them. She left thinking she never wanted to return, but circumstances brought her back, and now she can't picture leaving the community.
It's been such a cool thing to do over the past 10 years, you know, just developing this city and kind of changing people's perception of it and making it cool and hip and creating these events. And yeah, it's been really rewarding, and the job's not over yet, but there's still some negativity, like, oh, not all parts of downtown Toledo are great, or, you know, the areas outside the city need development. Sure. But I work alongside a lot of those folks, like in the city, the economic development department, that are actually doing that work, and it's happening. So, you know, it's just getting the word out and telling those stories and putting out those press releases and having grand openings for new businesses and stuff like that. You know, I think one of the challenges was we weren't telling those stories in a meaningful way that was getting out to the public. So I'm excited to do that. And I'm excited to tell those stories of these businesses and these artists and everything that are happening. And I think we've done a really good job of doing that in the past year.
Jalen is also committed to sticking it out downtown.
What Jay-Z said, you know what I'm saying? Don't die of the block, but buy it and invest in it, and it'll probably be worth millions. So I would love to be here and enjoy it, but it's just, I don't want to be stuck here and feel like I could be doing better somewhere else.
Jalen and Ash think that Toledo is on the cusp of something big. It's the reason that they've invested in the city. But they both know that there's still work to be done. Even Jalen's patience is wearing thin. Mel Monaghan just got tired of waiting for the city to turn that corner, so she left. What does downtown Toledo need to keep the Jalens and the Mels, to convince more young people to commit to a city in progress? To sing a different tune.
Less than a block away from Party in the Park, the streets are desolate. The gigantic office buildings, like mountain peaks, glow in the warm evening sun, as the vibrations of the music resonate in the stillness. As we walk to the car, an unusual contraption comes our way. Canopy bar on four wheels. 15 young people sit on bicycle seats, their feet pedaling below as they drink, laugh, and chatter. They pass us and continue down the all but empty street.
So wiv and wet wiv, let this be our motto, and let's let the sleeping dogs lie. So here's to the dogs of Toledo, Ohio. Ladies, we bid you goodbye.
Brain Drain is a mid-story podcast written and hosted by Dea Kukeli and by me, Yannick Schaller. Additional reporting on this episode by Yasu Shinazaki. Our editors are Logan Sander and Samuel Chang. Sound design and engineering on this episode is by yours truly. Original artwork for the series by Ruth Cheng and Joshua Rep. Data analysis by Chai Sha Tsui, Anna Diasio, and Itong Jiang. Fact checking by Terry Brisky. Special thanks go to our lovely team of interns who called Toledo home for at least a summer. Anavi Prakash, Yasu Shinazaki, Rajan Carson, Martin Barreto, and Desiree Lua. For more information, research, and reading material, please check out the show notes for this episode, available at midstory.org/braindrain. If our reporting has struck a chord or a nerve, we want to hear from you. Reach us on social media or via email at braindrain@midstory.org. Thanks for listening.
Enjoyed this podcast episode? Brain Drain and the many stories produced by MidStory are made possible in part by listeners like you. To support Midwest Stories and help us uplift our home, check us out at midstory.org or on our socials. If you're just joining us now, you're currently listening to the Midstory Hour. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear hidden stories from Toledo, the Midwest, and beyond. You can also find this podcast on midstory.org or WGTE.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's next story is part of Withstanding, a mini-documentary series and exhibition featuring six adaptive reuse projects from across Ohio, from bustling North Columbus to quiet Kings Mills, from Northeast Ohio's Cleveland and Oberlin to the glass capital of the world, Toledo. Join us as we uncover stories of Ohioans' creativity and innovation. These sites, ranging from schools to warehouses to factories, reflect how our past has been shaped by the forces of industry, migration, education, and more. And their transformation shows how Ohioans are reimagining the future of our state's built heritage. The story you'll listen to today begins in 1999, when a group of educators and parents dreamt of building an art school in Toledo. It was an audaciously hopeful idea amidst economic decline. 25 years later, the Toledo School for the Arts is thriving in a building once home to manufacturing titans Willys Overland and Owens, Illinois. In 2022, a new renovation reimagined a century-old shopfront space as part of the school's mission to be a positive force in the wider arts community. Here's that story now.
It's 1945, and the world is celebrating the end of World War II, largely thanks to over 639,000 Jeeps produced in Toledo, Ohio by Willys Overland. Flash forward to the 1950s, and the Owens, Illinois company has reinforced Toledo as the glass capital of the world. What do these revolutionary innovators have in common with an arts-focused charter school? The answer is simple. 333 14th Street, Toledo, Ohio.
The actual Toledo School for the Arts building was constructed by the Overland Car Company. It was a finishing plant, and they were bringing them here, ultimately showing them off in the showroom on the first floor for sales. We are on Adams Street, which was a very important corridor and hub for activity in the city of Toledo. I think what makes the building really unique, it does still show how versatile old spaces can be. You know, when you think about being in the Rust Belt, how many vacant, abandoned buildings are out there, and what possibilities could they be turned into? Well, if Toledo School for the Arts is the example of that, it's endless, it's limitless at that point.
When we first started the school, we were looking for a sponsor. So we approached a local school system, and one of the people involved in that decision-making process told our first director that there'll be an art school in Toledo when pigs fly. And so at the very first meeting with 125 students and their parents, he said, well, ladies and gentlemen, today pigs fly. We don't know how long they're gonna fly, but today they fly.
When we were thinking of leaving the original building, there were a lot of thoughts about, well, should we go out to one of the suburbs? But the board chose to remain downtown.
We probably toured about 20 buildings downtown. When we got to this building, it had two really good qualities to it. One is, it's made of concrete. Each floor is about 16 to 20 inches thick of concrete. And if you look around, right behind me, these pillars, they hold the building up.
Since its construction as a Willis Overland finishing plant in 1916, the solid structure has attracted Toledo's finest innovators for decades. In 1948, Owens, Illinois, the world's largest glass container manufacturer, took over the building and named it the DuraGlass Center, a research facility focused on improving the durability of its products. So if you still enjoy a nice glass bottle of Coke, you have OI and 333 14th Street to thank. But if you are a plastic Coke bottle kind of person, you still have this hardy building to thank.
When I needed laboratory space, it was called the Menlo Park Innovation Center. Owens, Illinois had abandoned the building and sold it to a guy named Ken Closter. It was looking for companies that were starting up and doing new things. I happened to need new space, and so they had big elevators, so I could put equipment in there and take it up to the third floor, and we put in our first little manufacturing operation, and we had all our laboratories and all our offices up there.
The production of vehicles or glass products, it's an industrial process. And in a lot of cases, you can see the influence in some of the production and art that comes out of the student work at Toledo School for the Arts.
So they're using shells as their paint bowls, right? So they can mix up all their paint in a little shell, grinding it up with the rocks. We have stone tools and flint for them. They've got feathers here for paintbrushes. It looks like so you have 18-year-olds who are in a humanities class and they're finger painting right now. I don't really see it that way. I see it as this is an important skill for like art historians, preservationists, right? They're matching hue and color. They're really focusing really deeply. I mean, like even on the cracks or the veins that are in the rock. Theater techs, right? People who build sets, people who do costume design. I don't think it's like a terrible, crazy idea to actually think about them doing this.
In an art school, industrial features like the freight elevator found new and creative uses.
One of the huge benefits for us has been the freight elevator that used to haul the cars, you know, up and down when they were painted on the top floors and then brought down to be sold. We can load a ton of instruments. We've got a lot of drums or large basses that have to be moved, and it's very easy. We just put them on the freight elevator and go up and down.
One of the other advantages is that this is an art school. It's got a lot of loud noises, it's got a lot of dancing, it's got a lot of jumping, and you have to isolate those spaces. You have 12 inches of concrete just to start with.
As enrollment grew in the early 2000s, school administrators found themselves needing to go outside the box, quite literally, for more and better space.
The entire first floor was mostly glass when the building was originally constructed, and then over time, they took what was all storefront and added these limestone panels on the entire first floor. And so the opportunity to really open up the first floor and bring it back to a storefront and an approachable environment was huge.
We never planned on calling it the Portal. We built it, and all of a sudden, like, what do we call it? And somebody said, it's the Portal. So the Portal is where the arts unite the community with Toledo School for the Arts. Evening classes, concerts, gallery shows, make and take spaces. I love this side of the building because it now looks like an art school. When people drive down the street, they look in here and they're like, oh, I wonder what that's all about. And people will come in and visit, and then we can educate them on the work that we do, because we are a community school, and without our community, we'd be nowhere.
We're just stewards, right? That's the real philosophy of historic architecture, is we don't own these buildings. They are going to continue long after us. So we have to take good stewardship of these buildings to pass them on to the next person that can reuse them.
This story was adapted for audio from one of our documentaries. If you'd like to watch the video version of this piece, as well as the documentaries for the other five sites featured in this project, visit midstory.org/withstanding. Withstanding is funded in part by the America 250 Ohio Commission and the Ohio Arts Council. This project is also supported in part by the Arts Commission and the City of Toledo and Lucas County. If you're just joining us now, you're currently listening to the Midstory Hour. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear hidden stories from Toledo, the Midwest, and beyond. You can also find this podcast on midstory.org or WGTE.org or wherever you get your podcasts. For 160 years, if you wanted to see some of the rarest coins in history, you would have had to go to New York City. But now, the American Numismatic Society is packing up its millions of dollars worth of treasure and moving to Toledo, Ohio. In a $20 million move set to be completed in 2028, the ANS will be relocating to its vacant building on the Toledo Museum of Art campus. Our fellow Yaffa Siegel had the opportunity to interview the director of the Toledo Museum of Art, Adam Levine, as well as ANS President Uta Wartenberg-Kagan, to learn more about why they chose Toledo and what historical currency we will be able to see. In a conversation with Midstory fellow Celia Johnson, Siegel discusses the move and the fascinating dimes, denarii, and doubloons coming to Toledo.
So you might have heard that there's a coin collection coming to Toledo, Ohio. In a recent announcement by the American Numismatic Society, it was announced that they are leaving New York City to relocate their headquarters to the Toledo Museum of Art. I'm currently reporting on this story, and I've had the opportunity to speak to Adam Levine, the director of the TMA, and Dr. Uta Wartenberg-Kagan, a historian and president of the American Numismatic Society, to learn more about the move and the partnership between the two institutions.
Well, that's super exciting.
I know.
Well, what made you, you know, interested in this story? Are you a coin collector yourself?
Not even a little. So at the beginning, I feel like, as most people, not thought a lot about coins. I feel like in our day-to-day lives, we're using credit cards, if ever we're using cash. And so when I was looking into this story, I was just very excited about how coins are connected to our history. And even though they're not as present in our day-to-day lives, we're still able to learn more about the artistry and the history from these objects.
What did you learn from talking to Levine and Kagan?
Well, what I realized is the study of coins isn't necessarily the study of coins themselves. What numismatics, which is the study of coins, attracts are art historians, regular historians, economists, and just really anyone who appreciates history, because coins are a physical record of a variety of conditions that led to their construction at the time. They're a piece of monetary value that is a chunk of currency. It's usually including some sort of art, so there's artistic value to that and the craftsmanship that goes into making it. And of course, there are the symbols that are included on these coins, why we use these symbols, for example, on American currency, which presidents get to make it onto coins, and what do we put on the back? Like, there are lots of considerations that go into that.
So it sounds like numismatics is a pretty multidisciplinary study. Is that right?
Definitely. I think there are especially a lot of interest in archaeology, because that is how these coins are unearthed. The American Numismatic Society especially is interesting because it's relatively new. It is the foremost research institution in the United States for coin collecting, because most other coin collections that have donated to, let's say, the British Museum, for example, these are sort of imperial and royal collections that have already been thoroughly cataloged since their inception. But the American Numismatic Society is interesting because they are still in the process of collecting and cataloging these coins. And they have a really great online database where they show the obverse and reverse of all of their coins. And they do a really great job of keeping a record of all of them. And because they are the American Numismatic Society, they're able to show really unique pockets of American history and how our currency has changed. And there's a lot of interesting developments that have occurred in order to make that happen. I mean, even just today, we now no longer mint the penny. And that may not seem that big of a deal, but now a penny is something out of history. And in 50, 100 years, that's going to be a collector's item. And the value of this penny is no longer just the metal that went into it.
That's super fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I love that the ANS is still in this process of researching and discovery. And so they were in New York City before, mm-hmm. is that right? So what made them want to leave?
Yeah. So the American Numismatic Society, interestingly, was founded by a teenager. He was 16 years old, and it was one singular coin, and he was talking to his friends about it. And that's sort of like the curiosity that created this organization in the first place. But throughout its existence, the Numismatic Society has had a lot of different organizational structures. And so they've had to move around New York many different times, from Washington Heights to Lower Manhattan. And the dream of the current administration has always been to have a money museum located on Wall Street in the financial district in order to show what is evident in these amazing coins is like history of economics. But unfortunately, Manhattan is very expensive and it's also not very big. And so for a very long time, they were devoting a lot of money and resources into just maintaining a presence in Manhattan and not being able to devote that money to their mission, to their education, to research. And also, New York has a lot of museums, over 170 museums that this relatively small cohort has had to compete with. And so they haven't had a lot of attendance in the last couple of years. And most of their coins are in drawers and they're not on display because there's no space. Now we are at a point where they've been looking for a new place to relocate for years already. And most recently, the Professional Arts Building in Toledo became vacant. And Adam Levine, the head of the TMA, had completed a fellowship at the ANS about 16 years ago. And he knew that the ANS was looking for a place to relocate. And it was only in a matter of 15 minutes, a phone call with Uta Wartenberg-Kagan, that she was convinced to make the flight and come take a look at the building. And she was very impressed by proximity to research institutions, the amount of space, and she was also especially excited about having a relationship with TMA, because the TMA is undergoing a major renovation and the museum will be completely restructured so that you can actually walk through it chronologically. And I remember Dr. Kagan told me about this, that most museums, especially in the United States, don't have coins. Coin collections aren't really a thing in most places because they're often overlooked. And so what's really exciting now is Toledo has all of the coins. And so they're very excited about integrating the ANS collection into pieces of the new renovation that's expected to be completed in 2027. And the ANS should expect to be integrated into the new museum in 2028. It's about $20 million worth of moving. So it's very exciting.
Wow, that's a big endeavor.
Yes, definitely.
So should Toledoans, the way you're describing it, will they be able to see the coins like in among the paintings at the TMA? Will it be interactive in any way? I don't know. Like, what will the experience be like for people visiting?
Yeah, so it's kind of up in the air at the moment. When I talked to Dr. Wartenberg, she said that they're actually still fielding suggestions about different ways to display coins, because some of the coins that they have are priceless and they're completely pristine. And so those are not going to be out for touching, right? Because of course, the way that people interact with coins is by holding them. You can hold them up to your face and you can see the indents and see how people held them in the time that they existed. But they also have a lot of less well-preserved coins, coins that are a little worse for the wear. And so what they're hoping is that they are able to have educational groups come in, schools, they're going to have a library and an auditorium, and they're going to be hosting lectures and probably other sorts of events. And I am certain that people will have an opportunity to interact with coins in a tangible way. And this is great because, you know, for people who are visually impaired, interacting with museum objects is often not possible. And so with the integration of coins, there's a way to make that a whole lot more accessible in an art history education sort of sense.
Huh, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. That is really cool, the idea of making art more accessible, which is a great thing to do. Well, you talked a little bit about the, you know, the ANS in part specializes in these pockets of American history, which is pretty unique. So, I mean, what coins from the collection should people be excited to see?
Yeah. Well, coins are interesting because they inherently hold value as metal, and that makes them really great as plot devices for a lot of old movies. And so there's one coin called the Brasher Doubloon, which was minted in post-revolutionary but pre-Constitution America. So under the Articles of Confederation, there was no federal minting process. And so there was a lot of miscommunication between states, and really anyone could mint a coin. And so you have this concept of non-sovereign currency that was created. And Brasher was just a silversmith living in New York, and he created these, some of the first United States gold coins, and they're modeled after coins minted in Peru, actually. And they boast a very beautiful EB stamp, and only 8 were ever created. And the ANS has one, which is really cool because I feel like the Articles of Confederation and that sort of era of history is not always talked about. And so being able to show someone this coin and talk about the context in which it was made is a really special piece of education.
Well, yeah, I can definitely see a Nicolas Cage movie being made about, you know, one of the only, these only 8 coins remaining
like
or ever
project.
Made in the U.S. Exactly, exactly. So, I mean, yeah, you mentioned some of these coins are pretty valuable.
Yes.
How are they going to be moving such valuable things to Toledo?
Yeah, so the ANS has over 800,000 pieces in its collection. That is nothing to sneeze at, and valuing millions and millions of dollars, unfortunately, I am not privy to that information. And that makes sense, right? Because having that information made publicly could potentially endanger the collections, because coin thieves and coin fraud are a very real problem. And many of the coins donated to the ANS throughout history have been the result of either by accident or on purpose, fraud, theft, because they're so little. And so it makes sense that they're being very careful and deliberate about what they're sharing about the transport. But it is interesting to think about how they'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we won't think too hard about it.
We won't think too hard.
You know? So how has this story changed how you view coins? Are you going to be holding on to all your pennies now in case they skyrocket in value?
Oh, yeah. There's a good handful of coins jingling around at the bottom of my bag, and I'm a little bit attached to them now. You know, I used to go through coins, and my dad was very interested in wheat pennies. And there are all these different sorts of coins that arise throughout American history. I mean, even now, the current penny is being lost. But the thing is, there are very real economic and historical reasons for doing so, right? Now the penny is costing more to mint than it's actually worth, and it makes sense for the government to stop producing them. And similarly, in ancient Rome, you can see how coins started being reduced with the amount of precious metal that was in them, because due to inflation, due to war, the government wanted to continue minting coins, but they didn't have the actual metal to do so. And being able to show somebody the denigration of these coins and illustrating modern inflation is a great way of doing that, because that's a pretty abstract concept. So in a way, I'm able to talk about coins with such passion right now because I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. I'm in. I get it now. And I'm very excited about this collection. I think it's going to be really great to integrate the TMA collection with the resources from the ANS and vice versa. And it's really going to be a comprehensive relationship, right? There's a lot of trust between them. And I think they don't know in all of the ways this relationship will come to be.
Well, you've certainly convinced me that coins are cool and that there's lots of great things on the horizon.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Is there anything we didn't cover you want to talk about?
Oh my goodness, I'm sure there is, because coins got a lot going on. But I think for now, I would just say get excited, because the ANS is going to have a lot of really great resources moving forward in Toledo. And it's going to be a really wonderful way to bring all sorts of collectors to the region.
Thanks for listening to the Mid-Story Hour. We have a full lineup for our next episode, so tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. to hear more about Mid-Story, our home and our greater region. If you have a story you'd like to share or just would like to drop us a note, please contact us at contact@midstory.org. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, see you soon.
The Mid-Story Hour is a Mid-Story podcast produced in collaboration with WGTE. It features original work produced by our dedicated team of reporters, researchers, data analysts, and creators. This episode was hosted by Samuel Chang, edited by Evan Blanco, and written by Logan Sander, Ruth Chang, and Samuel Chang. Artwork is by Ruth Chang and Joshua Rep, and this week's episode featured stories by the Greater Mid-Story team, including Deika Kelly, Yannick Schaller, Celia Johnson, and Yaffa Siegel. Mid-Story is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to progressing the Midwest narrative through multimedia storytelling, solutions-oriented research, and community programming. Founded in 2018 by four individuals who found their way home from the East Coast to Toledo, Ohio, Mid-Story re-envisions the Midwest story toward a productive, bright, and influential future. Learn more at www.midstory.org.